Okay, so what I'm going to aim to do in this paper is to start with some remarks about musical performance and creativity, but actually to use that as a kind of jumping off point to talk about some rather more general issues of theory and praxis that apply to music in the current and perhaps future university, and which apply perhaps more generally to other subjects in the humanities and even perhaps beyond the humanities. So let me start, though, with an example of creative practice in musical performance. The Sheffield-based or Sheffield-born guitarist Derek Bailey, who died in 2005, was arguably one of the most influential and radical exponents of that style of musical performance that is called free improvisation. Perhaps counterintuitively, given the epithet free, his spiky and at times fragmented seeming style is very distinctive and identifiable. If you haven't heard it before, then the short example I'm going to play in a minute may seem peculiar. And given that there is a certain kind of story around this example, all I will say is that if you listened to, he's a huge amount of recorded output by Bailey, and if you listen to quite a lot of it, you will find that what I play today is not a particularly and weirdly idiosyncratic example. It is characteristic of his playing. So in 2005, he released a CD called Carpal Tunnel. And the motivation for this title will become evident in a minute when I play the example. Here is a 2-minute extract from the opening roughly 10-minute track, which was entitled Introduction and Thanks, and which takes the form, or is conceived as, a kind of improvised open letter to a woman called Carol, who has clearly been in touch with Bailey by letter. There is a text to the improvisation, and because it's not terribly easy to hear, I'm giving it to you here. Now, a rather poignant feature of this remarkable and I think absolutely beautiful music is the sad fact that Bailey didn't have carpal tunnel syndrome, but actually the early stages of motor neuron disease, of which he was to die within a few months of the release of this CD. So what I want to draw attention to in this undoubtedly incredibly creative performance is the way in which Bailey's creativity emerges out of the complex combination of a musical tradition, not only free improvisation, but as actually he mentions, flamenco and other kinds of guitar traditions of which he was intensely aware. I should say he started out as a much more conventional jazz guitarist who developed this extraordinary free improvising style in the kind of late 1950s and early 60s. So grew out of a combination of these musical traditions, the affordances of a particular instrument and its particular opportunities, and the possibility and constraints of the human body with the particular limitations around which he is negotiating and which he is exploring. And the kind of research idea, to come back to some of the themes that Nick was talking about earlier, the idea of this kind of performance as research could hardly be more evident than in his own refusal to go down the medical route, but actually to explore what the possibilities of his relationship with the guitar under these conditions might afford. So it's a particularly striking and explicit case, I think, of a much more general principle that applies in different ways to all musical performance and is a vivid reminder of the very material and embodied character of what can sometimes seem like the abstract nature of creative practices. And that leads me to the broader themes of my paper. And they take the form of kind of three large dilemmas, followed by some approaches. Now, as again Nick has mentioned, and we actually hadn't rehearsed out the relationship between our papers at all, but it works out rather nicely, one of the real strengths of music in UK higher education, both at present and, I hope, in the future, is the way in which scholarship or academic work, or whatever we're to call it, and creative or practical practices of one sort or another, or more particularly, or more generally perhaps, the kind of whole relationship between theory and praxis, the ways in which those things coexist and interrelate and complement and just kind of hang together in music departments. It is, as Nick pointed out, very different from the continental European situation, and I would say actually is quite different even from the American situation, where although there are large music departments that have both practical and, if you like, theory-based activities, they tend to be very much more ghettoized than is the case in this country. And I think there is a long history of that in this country, and it is a very, very important strength of the UK system, and one which I think we must fight to preserve. It can be conceived in kind of more psychological language as the relationship between, as the important relationship between what psychologists call procedural and declarative knowing, the kind of knowing how to do things that is often illustrated or embodied in the riding of a bicycle, and the kind of declarative knowing about things that is perhaps illustrated by people's, I don't know, knowledge of tonal harmony through theory textbooks. And it is clearly the relationship between, the constant kind of translation between the procedural and the declarative and vice versa, that in which the richness of human knowledge lies. And so from the kind of procedural side, music departments have always incorporated performance, composition, and a whole kind of collection of different kinds of practical activities that are often referred to as musical techniques. People talk about techniques teaching in music departments, which often brings together keyboard skills and oral skills and knowledge of harmony and counterpoint that is, or of harmony more generally, that is brought about through quasi-compositional, pastiche-compositional sometimes activities. It is the existence of that within music departments, which are also looking at theory of music and history of music and the psychology of music and all these other kinds of things at the same time. And Christopher Small, in a book called Musicking, written just over 10 years ago, talks about how damaging the noun music is and how preferable the gerund musicking is, because it relates, it brings to the fore the way in which musicking is largely an activity rather than a thing. And so in that relationship, lies the kind of dilemma about research and creative practice that Nick was talking about, both more generally and in the very specific context of that REE 2001 panel, which is indeed very much, I remember it very much in the terms that Nick described it just now. So it's for this reason that musical performance and composition and that whole ragbag of different musical skills that are brought together under the term techniques and techniques training continue to play a vitally important part in many music degrees, as well as in definitions and assessment of research. And there is no doubt that it is that relationship between the procedural and the declarative that leads to the most powerful insights and experiences in relation to music. But that relationship, there would be a danger of idealizing it. It is a relationship that is not without its own significant and serious problems. And just two of them are, first of all, the very obvious and practical reason that enormous amounts of time, effort, and commitment are necessary to develop either side of what can sometimes seem like a binary divide. A violinist who wants to become really excellent at being a violin player has to put in so much time, as research by people like John Saboda and others have shown, has to put in so much time and commitment into that activity to reach the kinds of standards that the professional musical world requires, that it's extremely difficult to find a way to balance that against within educational programs, to balance that against the requirements of the kind of academic study of music that go on. And hence, in conservatoires, there tends to be this, what people sometimes perceive as a kind of imbalance between the enormous amount of time that is spent on instrumental learning and instrumental practice versus the academic skills. And by contrast, there is then the perception from the conservatoire side that the standards of performance that are required and attained at many, though not all, in many but not all university music departments are not commensurable with those that are obtained in conservatoires, where people just put all their eggs in that particular basket. And having been an external examiner at the Guildhall School of Music in London some time ago now, for a time, I remember being completely astonished when I turned up to their recital exams, their undergraduate recital exams, and was sitting there, not as an examiner, but just as an observer, listening to some, you know, violinist or pianist, mostly actually the string players, playing and thinking, oh my God, having just come from City University, which is where I was a lecturer at the time, I was thinking, you know, do we give this 88 or 92? It's, you know, so good that it's kind of off the scale virtually. And at the end of which, David Takano, head of strings, would say, well, I suppose that wasn't bad. It might just about pass. And by contrast, then looking at the academic work sometimes from those institutions, you thought, well, you know, these are final year students. Could they not have written better than this even before they came into the first year about music? So one of the things is just that the standards that we require in either of these two sides of what can seem like the two sides of a coin, either of these two sides are extraordinarily high, and it is very difficult to do both of them. And the second problem is perhaps the diversity of approaches that ought to be seen on both sides of this coin. If you're a violinist, are you just the kind of violinist who plays, you know, unaccompanied Bach and the sonatas of Beethoven and the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto and perhaps a piece by Takemitsu or something like that? Or do you also learn Carnatic violin playing and jazz violin and Irish folk fiddling and all of those other kinds of traditions of violin playing that arguably a musician in the 21st century should be learning? But how can you possibly do all of those things in, you know, within the limits of 24-hour days and 365-day years? And equally, from the academic side of this coin, do you just learn about classical music, or do you learn about the variety of musical practices? So this leads me on to my two other dilemmas that are already up on the screen. The interdisciplinary diversity of musicology, which, as Nick has already pointed out, is a fantastic and I think a wonderful way in which musicology has developed over the last kind of, I don't know, 25 to 50-ish years. How do you cope with that enormous interdisciplinary diversity and, on the other hand, the desire, the need to have some kind of, if you like, monodisciplinary depth? And here, just let me give you a couple of sound clips. Let's say you're studying contemporary British dance music, and you listen to the fifth track of the debut album by the Manchester-based electronic dance duo Lamb, called Zero, the track, and you hear this music. So that is the beginning of a dance track, although it doesn't sound like it. Now, to anyone who, I think most people, let's say, who have done some work in the area of the Second Viennese School, certainly to me, when I first heard it, I thought, wow, this is a reference to the Berg Violin Concerto, which starts also with these kind of ascending and descending arpeggiated fifths. And this might not, this might seem like a typical kind of Sude's Corner reaction of an Oxford academic to contemporary dance music, but actually there is more evidence on the disc itself that this relationship with classical music is not something that I'm projecting onto it, but is actually something intrinsic to their music. Another of their tracks is called Goretzky and samples that Goretzky symphony, which at the time was hugely popular at that time. So there is clearly some negotiation with Western art music going on here. And to fail to hear the reference then, perhaps the reference, to the Berg Violin Concerto at the start of this music is similar to the way in which within Berg's own music he makes reference to other Western music. So here is a famous passage from the lyric suite in which the Tristan progression is incorporated into what is otherwise an atonal piece of music. It's the sixth movement of the lyric suite. And there again, if one didn't hear that this was a reference to the Tristan progression and all that the Tristan progression kind of comes to represent in Western music, and the fact that the Tristan progression itself has to be seen as being somehow the outgrowth of that kind of functional tonality, perhaps most kind of canonically represented by Beethoven's use of harmony, in which the function of harmony is to articulate form and large-scale structure and so on. If one didn't know all of those things, those other kinds of things, what then do those sounds embedded in the middle of the lyric suite really mean at all? And so we're caught in this dilemma of, on the one hand, wanting to have the extraordinary richness of the interdisciplinary diversity, the anthropology and acoustics and archaeology and psychology and neuroscience and media studies and history of technology and all of those things that are now part of musicology in one sense, of the desire to have all that, and yet the danger of that kind of loss of sensitivity within any one part of that disciplinary context that comes from deep immersion in one part of that interdisciplinary complex. Which leads on to the third dilemma, which is about what kinds of musical traditions, histories and repertories are we interested in engaging with, and the dangers of a too narrow notion of music. So this is the kind of ethno-pop WAM question, as I've put it, WAM being the preferred acronym for Western art music, which has been, you know, a topic of debate for a long time, but which was importantly brought into question in a collection of essays edited by Georgina Bourne and Dave Hesmondhaus, published in the year 2000, entitled Western Music and Its Others, which was indeed a kind of a serious and very important and extremely provocative investigation by a whole lot of authors of Western music and its others and how we negotiate those kinds of differences. But is also more recently in an extremely enlightening and provocative and interesting paper by David Clark, who is sitting here in the audience today, who's a professor of music at Newcastle, embodied in a paper entitled Elvis and Darmstadt. It's got a subtitle which neither David, I'm glad to say, nor I could remember. But I think the Elvis and Darmstadt says it all, because for those who are not musicologists, Darmstadt is a kind of a word that sums up a whole sort of patch in Western post-war music history. Darmstadt was a summer school held in Darmstadt, not surprisingly, a summer school for those composers, most conspicuously Boulez, Stockhausen, and at other times most of the kind of European avant-garde, a summer school where those composers got together and played each other's compositions and kind of involved themselves in the avant-garde of European musical culture. And what David's paper does is to look at the dilemmas of whose history, what history, and which history music history is concerned with. And the paper starts with a story. And the story is, and it's a true story, that David was teaching a lecture course called Music in Contemporary Culture at Newcastle at the time, which had up till that point been a kind of requirement for those doing what I'm going to call the straight music course. So the people studying largely Western music history and its relations. And just before the writing of this paper, a new degree course was started at Newcastle, which was a degree course in popular music. And those students also were now required to take the same Music in Contemporary Culture course, leading David to speculate about, well, what music history, what music in contemporary culture do these now two groups of students sitting together in the same class need to know about? And thus, as he goes on, it forced a kind of mental dialogics in which the history you're telling suddenly collides with an image of the different history you might and arguably should also have been telling under these altered demographics. It brings into vivid focus the fact that Stockhausen Zeitmesse and Nonno's Il Canto Sospeso are exactly contemporaneous with Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel and Chuck Berry's Rollover Beethoven, all 1956. This imagining of musics normally kept in their safely historical containers, now rearticulated in a potentially volatile chain of meaning, was what I term my Elvis and Darmstadt realization. And I think it's a kind of realization that many of the others of us in the room have had, either with music or with other kinds of historical artifacts, is suddenly realizing the contemporaneity of things that seem to be in such different worlds from other others. And the rest of the paper, which I went for a moment to try to summarize, is a kind of exploration of what it would be, or whether we should try to bring together those different worlds, and into what kind of relationship can we and should we bring them? How can you talk about Elvis and Darmstadt? And is it even wise to try and do so? So, going from those dilemmas to my last shortish section on different approaches, how then might we approach the dilemmas of the interdisciplinary variety of music and the need for disciplinary depth, and returning to the kind of original starting point for this paper and the theme of this session, the relationship between the kind of creative practices in music and the scholarly academic activities, practices, again, that it involves. Well, one way might be to slice the same cake differently. I mean, it remains then a kind of cake, a reified thing, music, that we think we're dividing up. But rather than thinking about, you know, the madrigal in the 17th century, we might have courses which are just called lines or something like that, in which you look at linear monody in a whole lot of different world traditions. You might think of monody in plain chant, in rap, in shakuhachi music, or in the Inuit throat music known as katajak, in which people sing to each other into each other's throat, or in Indian drupad singing. So there could be a whole lot of different ways in which the idea of linearity in music is explored across these kind of cultural and, actually, in that case, historical dividing lines. Or one might have a course, again, just on virtuosities, in which you look at both Liszt and Jimi Hendrix and the Amadinda xylophone playing of Uganda and again, katajak singing, actually, which is a virtuosic kind of singing. Or you might look at gender issues, not only in hip, but in hip-hop as well. So not only in historically informed performance, where there have been some very interesting, to an untutored eye, I think anyway, interesting shifts in kind of gender relationships, in who the performers are and who the significant people are in historical informed performance as compared to mainstream performance. And similarly in hip-hop, largely, you know, a kind of male musical genre, but again, a one in which women have taken interesting roles as well. The danger here, as I put up, is a kind of tokenism and the danger of making false homologies across both historical and cultural boundaries. But it does offer at least a way of breaking out of the kind of narrow constraints of single cultures and single histories. Okay, and the second approach to these dilemmas might be, to go back to this issue about creative practice or creative activities, is to pluralize the notion of techniques in the same sort of way. So we don't just teach keyboard skills and tonal harmony, but actually, given that the vast amount of the world's music is now in one way or another in some kind of recorded and broadcast form, that we teach people studio techniques, either to do those studio techniques or at least to know about what those kinds of studio techniques are from a very practical point of view, so that when you hear a piece of music recorded, you know how the sort of spatialization effects or the reverb or the particular kind of balance between instruments has been produced in that recording. So we teach them studio techniques, and we teach them improvisation, and perhaps we teach them songwriting. I don't know, there could be a huge list then of what we mean by techniques, which retains the same relationship between the kind of procedural and the declarative, but doesn't confine us in this kind of ghetto of harmony and counterpoint and keyboard skills. Or one could adopt the kind of approach that the York Music Department has been adopting for, I think, probably nearly 40 years now, and that is to teach music, to study and to understand music through what they call their project approach. In this kind of approach, typically, students across the 3 years of the degree get together in groups and do a project on, let's say, Schoenberg's Pierre Lunaire or something like that, in which some students are involved in performing part of that work, some students are involved, and they may be some of the same students as well, some students are involved in doing some analysis of the work, some students are involved in constructing appropriate scenery, perhaps, for a partially staged one, which might involve them in turn in looking at, you know, art theoretical ideas with people like Kandinsky, who was a kind of close collaborator at one stage with Schoenberg, and so on. So you can imagine that and then others looking at the history of, you know, the Second Viennese School and Schoenberg and Pierre Lunaire in particular. So you could imagine within this kind of project approach that one might bring together these procedural and declarative, or not imagine, the York Music Department do this regularly, bring together the procedural and the declarative in a kind of intense project-based approach to these kind of areas in music history. The downside of this might be, as I put it here, patchiness, that one gets to know some little bit of this musical ground very well, but arguably that it kind of floats in some sort of strange vacuum, and you don't know whether Pierre, you know, did Schoenberg's Pierre Lunaire come before or after, I don't know, Mahler's Fifth Symphony or something like that. You know, what are the historical, even just the temporal relationships between the thing that you know, these things that you know about that float around? And having done my own degree at Sussex University, which was partially influenced in some ways by some of the kind of York ethos as well, I certainly came out from that degree with all kinds of interests and curiosities, but actually an incredibly flimsy and patchy knowledge of the continuities of music history. It's not terribly much better now. And there are also, from having spoken to people who went through the York system, I think there are issues of power in the kinds of teaching and collaboration that's involved. If you're the kind of confident undergraduate who says, oh yeah, I'm happy to conduct a couple of movements from Schoenberg Pierre Lunaire, and we can do it like this and do it like that, then, you know, the York system works fine. But if you're the less confident, perhaps first year undergraduate in this group, who's come from a quite different kind of education, what happens then? Are you just kind of swamped by this sense that other people know everything and you don't really have a space in which to, a more structured space in which to learn? And finally then, and this is the kind of vision, I suppose, that David encourages us to think about at the end of his Elvis and Darmstadt paper, is a more generalized approach, really, of encouraging and relishing the type of multiplicity and what he calls the agonism, as opposed to the antagonism, the agonism of a kind of approach to music in which we recognize that there are these powerfully different kinds of approaches, of conceptual frameworks, of practices and scholarships and so on that are never going to be reconciled. And actually it's a false dawn to think that we are going to try and reconcile them, and it would be a much less interesting state of affairs, a more comfortable but less interesting state of affairs, if we were to recognize them. And he goes through an interesting kind of three-part transition from what he calls a weak relativism within this massive difference. A weak relativism in which one essentially, you know, occupies a particular place in that universe and enjoys dipping into the kind of exotic fruits of other parts of the whole array. To a strong relativism, and I suppose it goes without saying that kind of rather culinary approach to difference is one, certainly in a kind of post-Said context, we probably are and should feel profoundly uncomfortable with, through to a kind of strong relativism that says, you know, I occupy my space in this universe and I notice and I respect the integrity of other spaces within this universe, but we exist in a kind of antagonistic and kind of partially mutually not understanding relationship with one another, a kind of strength of difference, but a rather profound difference, through to the kind of third part of this transition, which David calls a dialecticized dialogism, which comes out of a kind of reading and understanding of both Bakhtin and Slavoj Žižek, in which one sees the kind of dialogical relationship between those positions of difference as not being one that is in this state of kind of negative antagonism, but one in which the kind of gaps, and this is the kind of terminology that David himself uses, the gaps between these different positions are seen not as absences, but as opportunities, as openings, rather than lacks, if you like. And so that the tension that exists, and this is why it's agonism and not antagonism, the tension that exists between these different positions, and they can be the differences between different music histories or between the difference between declarative knowledge and scholarship on the one hand and procedural knowing and practice on the other, that those differences coexist with one another and constantly eternally negotiate with one another, but in a process that in the end moves forward to different opportunities, not to some kind of bright dawn that we can identify as being over there somewhere, but in a process that is never ending. And at that point, I will end. Thanks very much.